Introduction to the Letter to the Romans, the second talk in a series on Romans, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 19, 2009 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're going to start the book of Romans. I'm really excited about this because Romans has been my home in the New Testament. I keep coming back there. It's where I started my journey of theology and understanding the Bible. That's where I keep coming back to. It's changed my life several times. I just keep adjusting my understanding the more I wrestle with the text and confront the text and realize I don't quite have it right, and I have to go back and make adjustments. So it has been the source of a number of paradigm shifts in my life. I think I understand it now. I always reserve the right to change my mind, but I think I finally understand what's going on in the letter. So I think I'm ready to teach it, and that's what we want to do over the next several months. I'm going to do some stuff that might and probably will be a little bit boring this morning. It's orientation to the letter. But the reason I'm bothering with it, I wouldn't normally bother with it, but I think it's crucial. It was crucial to me in understanding what exactly is this letter. Because if you don't get oriented to the book right, then you draw wrong conclusions about what you're seeing and what you're reading there. So you have to know why he's writing it and what he's trying to accomplish and what the issues are that he's addressing, or else you make it something else. You turn it into something different. I mean, that's the problem we always face studying the Bible, is that we come to the Bible with my questions and my issues, and we're immediately tuned in to the text to have the text address or answer my questions and my issues. And it takes a certain amount of discipline to realize that Paul has issues and questions of his own that he's addressing, and he hasn't asked me whether they are mine. He's addressing them because they are the issues that he thinks his readers need to hear, and I was not one of his original readers. So no matter where you are in the Bible, that's always an issue. But in the book of Romans, for historical reasons, that's become a huge problem. So that's what I want to talk about this morning. Who wrote it? When did he write it? Where did he write it? And most importantly, why did he write it? First word in the Greek text is Paul. He's the author. Paul was a Jew born in Tarsus, which would be Western Turkey today, on the coast of Western Turkey. Born in Tarsus, he was a Roman citizen probably by his father. Oftentimes, Rome would come against a city to conquer it, and rather than an expensive and long, drawn-out siege, they'd offer citizenship to every citizen in the city if they would surrender. And that's likely what happened, is that everyone in the city, including Paul's father, was offered citizenship upon surrender. They likely surrendered to the Romans and were all granted Roman citizenship. So Paul comes by his citizenship in something like that way. At the age of 13, 14 or so, we know that he went to Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem studying under Gamaliel the First. Gamaliel the First was the most famous rabbi in the first century. So Paul studied under the best, the most famous. About that time, he would have been very young as the resurrection has happened and the church is beginning to get going in Jerusalem. And Paul takes it upon himself as a Pharisee of Pharisees, the way he describes himself, to stamp out this crazy idea that Jesus was the Messiah. So he actually becomes one of the prime organizers of an effort to, and implementers, I should say, of an effort to arrest, imprison, beat, maybe even kill these people who are advocating Jesus being the Messiah. He's actually literally on a journey to Damascus to round up believers who have fled to Damascus and bring them back to be tried by the Sanhedrin. He's on his way there when he has an encounter, a supernatural revelatory encounter with Jesus on the road to Damascus. After this conversion, he enters into some period of learning and rethinking everything that he believes. We don't know exactly. We know that part of that time was spent in Saudi Arabia, Nabatea, probably. Some of that time was spent in Tarsus, back home in Tarsus. It's hard to put that chronology together, but between various locations, he isn't doing nothing. He's just thinking things through, studying his scriptures, reorienting himself toward Torah, toward the prophets, toward what they taught, in the light of the reality that Jesus really was the Christ. Eventually, Barnabas, a guy who plays a significant pivotal role in church history, Barnabas takes it upon himself to travel from Antioch in Syria up to Tarsus and fetch Paul, saying, "Paul, we need you. We need your knowledge. We need your understanding. We need your mind. Come down here to Antioch." So he goes down to Antioch, which is one of the first really thriving churches that incorporates both Jews and Gentiles together. It was a cosmopolitan city with a lot of Gentiles. And so Paul begins to minister as a teacher of Torah in the midst of a Jewish Gentile community. That community commissioned him and sent him off to spread this word to wider reaches and to Gentiles in other places, to try to saturate more of the Roman Empire with this message. So he goes on what is typically called his first missionary journey, first to Crete, then to what then was called Galatia on the southern coast of Turkey. And after that, returns to Antioch, gives a report, and then a few years later is sent on a second missionary journey. In that missionary journey, he travels up through modern-day Western Turkey, all the way into Macedonia, down the Greek peninsula to ultimately ending up in Corinth. He decides he wants to go back to Jerusalem. He heads back by way of Ephesus, has a little brief stint in Ephesus, and then makes his way back to Jerusalem and then back up to Antioch in Syria. That ends in about 52 AD. Then in 53 AD, he goes on a third missionary journey. And he basically retraces his steps. He goes to Ephesus first, spends a significant amount of time in Ephesus, probably in 54 to 56. Somewhere in there, he probably travels back and forth between Corinth and Ephesus. But then eventually, he retraces his steps up to Macedonia, extends his reach over to Illyricum, which is on the Adriatic side of the Greek peninsula, and then down the peninsula ends up in Corinth. And that's where we find him when he writes the letter to the Romans. Paul was very well aware of his, self-consciously aware of his role as being the apostle to the Gentiles. That he was not self-appointed, at least if you believe him, he was not self-appointed. From the very beginning, when Jesus first confronted him on the road to Damascus and the events surrounding that, it is made clear to him that he is being specifically captured by Jesus. He's a victim of the grace of God to become a servant of Jesus in order to take this message to the Gentiles. Don't know why Paul, but Paul was the one that God picked to be instrumental in having that role. I want to talk briefly about how are we to understand this. It probably wouldn't normally have to talk about this, but with all the books out there and all the PBS things that we watch on TV and all the stuff that we watch on Discovery, that try to make sense out of the origins of Christianity. You have to understand the assumption that all of those scholars and all of those movie producers are working out of. And that is, they insist on some kind of naturalistic explanation of the origins of Christianity. Paul's view of the origins is very simple and very straightforward. I was going one direction in my life, and I had this encounter with Jesus that completely called into question everything that I believed, everything that I was doing, everything that my life was all about. And I was taught that there's a whole nother way to understand the Old Testament scriptures and how Jesus of Nazareth, who is the Messiah, corresponds to what the scriptures taught. There's a whole new way to understand that, and it was taught to me. It was revealed to me. It was shown to me. Typically, especially in academic circles, they try to find some kind of psycho-emotional source within Paul himself as to where he came up with these new, novel, creative, strange ideas. Well, from Paul's perspective, they're not new. They were there all along. He was just too blind to see them. He was blinded by prejudices and paradigms that were the lenses through which he looked at it, so that he could read the prophets before and not even get it. But with the combination of this shocking encounter with a Jesus that he thought was dead and thought was irrelevant, with a shocking encounter with him, combined with training by Jesus himself, it would appear from some things Paul says that Jesus appeared to him personally and taught him some things, as well as his own reevaluating of the scriptures in the light of a new openness to hear what they had to say. That's the source and origin of his theology. He didn't make any of it up. He wouldn't ever have claimed the imagination and the creativity to invent a new religion. All he's doing is being taught, and he sees himself as a faithful proclaimer and passer-oner of that which has been given to him, what has been revealed to him, what has been taught to him, what has been discovered by him. That's what he's passing on in his ministry. The tragic thing is how many academic scholars, especially, who are themselves believers, I'm convinced, but they hold beholden to the spirit of this age, to the zeitgeist, to make it sound like that we find in Paul some especial readiness to invent these ideas that, lo and behold, they were actually true, but even though he invented them. I just think that's odd. You know, Paul himself doesn't claim to have invented any of this stuff. Okay, to whom did he write? But this is the author of this letter. This the apostle to the Gentiles who has had a life-transforming experience through an encounter with Jesus that he thought was gone, and through his own reevaluation of what the scriptures teach. He came to understand the truth of the prophets themselves, and he came to convey that to the world, and especially to the Gentiles. In order to come to understand to whom he's writing it, there are two key pieces of information, I think. One is historical, and one is a judgment about what's going on in the book of Romans itself. First one is historical. We have to know about the edict of Claudius to order the Jews out of Rome. In about 49 AD, no later than 49, perhaps a little earlier, but no later than 49 AD, there was a huge riot in Rome. And the riot began and incorporated most of the Jewish community. One of the Roman historians, I don't remember which one, attributes the cause of the riot to someone named Crestus. Now, Crestus means useless, and it was a common slave name. But the way it would have been pronounced then, Crestus and Christos would have been virtually indistinguishable. So many historians today just simply assume that that historian has mistaken the word Christos for Christus, and that in fact this riot ensued because of one named Christos, the Christ, the Messiah. We know from the book of Acts that riots ensued everywhere Paul went. Everywhere the name of Christos was named, eventually the Jewish community rioted. It happened in Ephesus, it happened in Thessalonica, some famous riots in a number of different places. So it's not at all unlikely that it would have happened in Rome. Now, Paul has not been there. This is before this letter. Why is the name Christos even showing up in Rome? No one really knows the origin of the Roman Church, but it began actually quite early. And the most plausible explanation is we do know from the book of Acts that there were people from Rome there on the day of Pentecost, pilgrims to Jerusalem, who had traveled from Rome to take part in the festival, and they were eyewitnesses to the happenings at the day of Pentecost, as well as the preaching of Peter. And many of them hung around, we know, for a number of days in the kind of Christian Woodstock experience where they did nothing but were taught, were trained morning and night in the apostolic teaching. They got them all up to speed on what's been going on and what happened and what does all this mean and what is the significance of all that. So by the time they left, they went back to Rome believers who were trained, believers who had been taught, maybe not taught with the thoroughness that an Apostle Paul would eventually train people, but nonetheless, believers who are informed believers. They went back to Rome and apparently began proclaiming that within the Jewish community in Rome. Well, eventually, it reached a boiling point, and in 49 AD or so, there was a riot. Claudius, who was the emperor at the time, would have none of it. His solution, like any good Roman emperor, is, then no Jews in Rome at all. All of you, out of here. And so he literally banished believing and unbelieving Jews, all of them out of Rome, and they had to leave. We know from the book of Acts that Aquila and Priscilla were originally from Rome. They show up in Corinth because Claudius kicked them out. And that's where Paul meets up with them, and they become lifelong companions and fellow workers and friends of Paul. The edict lasts until basically the death of the emperor, so probably the expulsion is only rescinded at Claudius' death, which was in October of 54 AD. So we have a period of at least 5 years where these Jews are not in Rome. So that's the first piece of information, because I think it's right in the heart of that history that we see the letter of Romans being written, and it's going to go a long way toward explaining why he's writing the letter, I will argue. But we'll get to that in a second. The other thing is to recognize that what we have in our Bibles as chapter 16 is not the end of Romans. Chapter 16, I'm going to argue, is actually a cover letter, a separate document that accompanied the letter to the Romans. And over the course of time, as it was being copied and preserved, what else do you do with it? You want to preserve it together with the letter. You either copy it before the letter or after the letter. They chose to copy it after the letter, and it just becomes basically an appendix to the letter. So chapter 16, in order to be rightly understood, I think, needs to be understood as standing alone as a separate cover letter on the one hand that in our Bibles has been simply stuck on as an appendage to it. If anyone is here new and visiting, on our website, my formatting and my translation is available in a PDF file. That's what I will mostly be referring to. I will try to remember to give you traditional chapter and verse if you're using your own Bible. So let me read that, and we'll start with that. You will notice, however, there's going to be a significant omission in my reading it from your Bible There's several verses that I think do not belong there, and I'll explain that in a second. So here's what I think was the original cover letter, starting with 16:1 in your other Bibles. Otherwise, this is page 34 on yours, part 30, the cover sheet accompanying remarks. "Now I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, since she is a servant from the gathering which is in Cenchrea, that you might welcome her as a follower of the Lord in a manner fitting of the Hagioi, and support her in any matter in which she might have need of you. For indeed she has been a patron of many, even of me personally. Greet Prissa and Aquila, my fellow workers in Messiah Jesus. These individuals put their own necks at risk for my life. Not only do I give thanks for them, but so do all the gatherings of the Gentiles, especially the gathering at their house. Greet Epaphroditus, my beloved. He is the first offering to the Messiah in Asia. Greet Mary. She has toiled much for you. Greet Andronicus and Junius, my kinsmen and my fellow prisoners. They are eminent among the apostles. Indeed, they came to be followers of the Messiah before me. Greet my beloved Ampliatus as a follower of the Lord. Greet Urbanus, our fellow worker, as a follower of the Messiah and my beloved Sakes. Greet Apelles, a tested and confirmed follower of the Messiah. Greet those from the household of..." Oops. Should be Aristobulus. "Greet Herodian, my kinsman. Greet those from the household of Narcissus, those who are followers of the Lord. Greet Tryphena and Tryphosa, individuals who have toiled as followers of the Lord. Greet the beloved Persis. She has toiled much on behalf of the Lord. Greet Rufus, chosen by the Lord. Also greet his mother and mine. Greet Asyncritus, Phlegon, Hermes, Patrobas, Herma, and the brothers with them. Greet Philogelus and I think that's spelled wrong too. Philologus. No, that's right. And Julia, Nereus and his sister, and Olympus and all the Hagioi with them. Greet one another with a holy kiss. All the gatherings of the Messiah greet you." Then he goes to another part. "I urge you, brothers, to watch for those who are proposing dissenting ideas, even dangerous traps, in conflict with the teaching that you have learned. Veer away from them, for such as these are not serving our Lord the Messiah. Rather, they are serving their own appetites, and by their specious talk and polished speech, they deceive the heart of the guilelessly undiscerning. Now, word of your obedience has reached everywhere. Therefore, I rejoice over you. Yet I want you to be wise in relation to what is good and uncontaminated in relation to what is evil. The God of Shalom will soon crush Satan under your feet. The grace of our Lord Jesus be with you. Timothy, my fellow worker, send you his greetings. Also, Lucius and Jason and Sosipater, my kinsmen." And then we actually have from not Paul's hand, but from the amanuensis, who's actually penning the letter as Paul dictates it. His amanuensis actually makes his own remark. "I, Tertius, the one writing this letter, greet you. Being a follower of the Lord, Gaius, host to me and to the whole believing community, sends you his greetings. Erastus, the city treasurer, sends you his greetings, and also Quartus, his brother. The grace of our Lord Jesus, the Messiah, be with all of you. Amen." Okay, that, I'm arguing, is a separate document. I left off a part that reads something like this, and this is typically, if you'll notice, if you have a real Bible, you'll notice that verse 24 is missing, even in your real Bible. It goes right from 23 to 25. Why is that missing? And then in 25, you have this. "Now I commit you to the one who is able to establish you in my proclamation of the good news, even the core essential truth about Jesus, the Messiah, which is in accord with the unveiling of a secret kept undisclosed in the times of past ages, yet has now been made manifest. Now in line with the writings of the prophets, this secret has been made known to all the Gentile peoples in accord with the commandment of the God of the ages to bring about an obedient response of belief. I commit you to the only wise God in view of Jesus, the Messiah, to whom is glory into the ages. Amen." There's no way you would know this from the English Bibles that we have, because they just don't. There may be some marginal notes that give you some kind of clue. But In the majority of Greek manuscripts, what I just read, that they call it a doxology, that doxology that I just read actually occurs after chapter 14, at the end of chapter 14, between 14 and 15. Everybody knows that's crazy. There's no way that's where it belongs, because the end of 14 and the beginning of 15 is right smack dab in the middle of an argument that he's making. I mean, he'd have to be, it's literally intruded into the middle of an argument that's not finished yet. You put a doxology after you're done, not right smack dab in the middle of it. So by the time you start getting Greek manuscripts being produced or Greek editions being produced in the Middle Ages, they realize that's not where it belongs, so they've put it somewhere else. Some manuscripts have it there at the end of 14 and where you have it in your English Bibles at the end of chapter 16. Others have it at the end of 16 and not at the end of 14, which is how our English Bibles read. They just put it at the very end. There's only one papyri that has it in what I'm going to argue is the right spot. And that's not at the end of chapter 14, but at the end of chapter 15, which would be the original end of the letter. If you recognize that 16 is not really part of the letter, but is a cover letter, then the end of the letter is actually the end of chapter 15, which is where the very, very ancient papyri, the Chester Beatty Papyrus, P46, has it in at the very end of the main letter, at the end of chapter 15. I'm going to argue, I think that's where it belongs. That's what makes the most sense. And I just think that there was some sort of mistake of transmission very, very, very early on that somehow, and in a way that I can't, is inexplicable to me, I don't understand, but it moved it over to 14. But that is so clearly not where it belongs that the scribes, in looking at that, realized that a mistake had been made, wanted to rectify the mistake, so put it what at that time seemed to be the end of the letter, the right place to put it, which was at the end of 16, because the cover letter had been so fused and appended to the letter that reasonably, understandably, they thought, well, that's the end of the letter, let's put it at the end. But I'm not sure anything is at stake here, but I think it belongs at the end of 15. So in my Greek text and in my translation, that's where you'll find it. As an end to the cover letter, I mean, if you just read that, I don't know if you can feel the weight of that doxology. The weight of that doxology is way out of proportion to the little brief memo that the cover letter is. But it's not at all out of proportion with the weighty, weighty arguments and evidences that he's given throughout the main body of the letter, many of which are alluded to in the doxology, that he alludes to the things that he's argued in detail throughout the letter. So it's an incredibly appropriate ending and finale to the letter. It is way over the top as an ending and finale to the Greet Mary and Greet Andronicus and so on and so forth. So it just seems to have its natural home there, and given that we have very early manuscript evidence that that's where they had it, I just think that has to be original. Okay, well, on the assumption that I'm right about those things, then look at the evidence that we have. The people in the cover letter that are being introduced to the notice the people in the cover letter being introduced to the intended recipients of the letter. Most commentators, and I really, frankly, I don't understand why, because this just makes no sense, and my proposal makes so much more sense to me, having given due consideration to its source. Most commentators read this as if the people that are being greeted are living in Rome and part of the Roman church. And so when he says, greet Mary, Mary is sitting in Rome receiving this letter from Paul, and we are to read that as, I, Paul, send my greetings to Mary. and that that's how we are to understand what's being said. But recognize there's another way to understand that that actually makes more sense, and that is Mary's not sitting in Rome. Mary's standing over here on the Appian Way, confronting the Roman church that he's writing the letter to, and Mary is being introduced to that church. You, the recipients of this letter, would you greet your newfound sister, Mary? Otherwise, how do you explain that in each and every case, he tells who the person is that he wants them to greet? She's been going to church with him for 10 years and, like, they don't know? You don't know that this person has toiled for the Lord? You don't know? I mean, all the comments that he makes about them, he's treating it like it's new information to the people that he's writing to. That only makes sense if he's asking them to greet someone who's a stranger to them, someone that they don't personally know. Another factor is that we know some of the people on the list. Notice that after Phoebe, the first ones mentioned are Aquila and Priscilla, or Prissa and Aquila. Well, we know who they are. They used to live in Rome. They got kicked out of Rome and went to Corinth. Paul gets to know them in Corinth. They actually travel with Paul to Ephesus at one point. So at another point in their life, they're at Ephesus. I think we happen to know that they make their way back to Corinth. They are being greeted in this letter. Most commentaries say, well, they've gone back to Rome now, and so Paul is greeting them in Rome, saying, I send my greetings to you. Could be. Or could it be that they are coming with the letter and that they are being reintroduced to the Gentiles in Rome who over the last 5 years have come into the Christian community and may not know who Priscilla and Aquila are because they're new Gentile believers in the Roman church. The commentators look at these names and they say, well, you know, some of them are Jews. Paul identifies some of them as Jews. He says they are my kinsmen. Others of them have Greek names, so maybe they're Gentiles. Yeah, maybe they're Gentiles, but all the Gentile names are slave names. All of them. I think without Phoebe, maybe not. Phoebe's the only questionable one. But all the other Greek names here are slave names. These appear to be freedmen. And a freedman in Roman society was someone who used to be a slave, has secured their freedom somehow, but although they are free, they don't have the same status as a citizen or any other normal Roman. They have certain restricted rights as a freedman. Well, we know that there are a lot of Jews who had been taken into captive and enslaved in the Roman Empire at various times. So, and slaves typically got Greek names. In fact, diminutive forms and various forms of Greek names that made it pretty clear of their status. So there's no clear evidence that anyone on this list is a Gentile. I mean, Paul is a Greek name, but he's not Gentile. There are all kinds of evidence in the New Testament of Jews who have Greek names but are nonetheless clearly and undoubtedly Jewish. So we don't have any clear evidence of any of these being Gentiles. They may all be Jews. Okay. All right. So putting all those pieces of information together, what are we to understand here? I think what's happening is Paul is in Corinth, and Paul is about to leave. We know from the book of Acts, he's about to travel from Corinth back to Jerusalem. He has this offering that he's taken up from all the churches in Achaia and Macedonia and Asia. He's taken up an offering from all the churches, the Gentile churches. He wants to take to Jerusalem, which is experiencing a famine, in order to help out the poor people in Jerusalem with this offering. And he's very intent on that. We'll see that at the end of the book of Romans, he comments on that. That's his focus right now. He knows that a boat is about to leave from Corinth to Rome with a bunch of his friends who were residents of Rome and are returning back home to Rome. This whole boatload of Jews is going to go back and all of a sudden is going to have to rejoin an entirely Gentile church that has been left behind in Rome. We know it has to be entirely Gentile because all the Jews have been kicked out of Rome. So this group of Jews who have been working with him and in the churches with him in Corinth are traveling back. Paul wants, in advance of him getting there, he wants this letter to go to Rome. So he writes this letter while he's in Corinth, on the verge of leaving, and gives it to one Phoebe. Phoebe is from Cenchrea. Corinth has two seaports, one on the Aegean side and one on the Adriatic side. Cenchrea is on the Aegean side. It would have been the port that Paul was going to leave from in order to sail back to Jerusalem. The other Jews would have been leaving from the other port on the other coast. So Phoebe, who's from Cenchrea, is given this letter to hand carry to the church in Rome, I would think. And why Phoebe? Well, she was a very prominent servant, we know, from the church in Cenchrea, and she's the one that's around when Paul needs to split. Because when we read the book of Acts, there's a plot against Paul. They discover that he's going to sail out to Jerusalem. Paul hears of the plot and changes his plans and travels overland back up through Macedonia rather than sailing in order to keep safe. So he probably had to leave and depart rather quickly, and imagine he's departing from Cenchrea where he was getting ready to sail out. So he puts this letter in the trust of Phoebe to deliver to the church at Rome. I think that's why Phoebe's mentioned first. You know, the woman who's going to deliver the letter, greet Phoebe or welcome Phoebe. Let me introduce you to Phoebe. Okay. So, believing Jews traveling back to Rome accompanied by this letter, that's why you have this long list of greet so-and-so and greet so-and-so and greet so-and-so and telling them who they are, because these are largely strangers to the Gentiles to whom the letters, both letters, are coming. All right. Three things follow from that scenario. If I'm right about that, three things follow. One, the letter is written to Gentile believers left behind in Rome after the Edict of Claudius. So the intended recipients are Gentiles. That's clear under that scenario. And the letter is written under circumstances in which Paul knows that two things are in the process of happening. There's about to be a great influx of Jews into Rome, if it is not already happening. It's about to be. And so the letter, what I'm arguing is the letter is written with a heightened awareness that that's the situation that the church in Rome is in. Here come the Jews, a great influx of Jews back into their community. And there's about to be a significant influx of believing Jews into the believing communities in Rome. And he's aware of that. And what I'll do in the next few weeks as we go over the basic outline of the argument, I'll show you how the themes and topics that he decides to talk about are highly relevant to that kind of situation. He knows what the obstacles are that they're going to face, and he's setting out to address those. And then finally, it follows in that scenario that the letter was written from Corinth, and I'm not sure that there's much at stake there, but I think it was written from Corinth. When did he write it then? Putting all that together and placing it in a time in Paul's chronology as well as the chronology of the Roman Empire. Then it would appear that it was written somewhere between 55 and 57 AD. F.F. Bruce sets it in the winter of 56 and 57. Not exactly sure why he pinpoints it so precisely, but it's somewhere between 55 and 57 AD. So why did he write it? If I could sum up the three reasons, they would come to, well, there are ultimately four, but there are three reasons that could be summed up this way. Paul's purpose is to prepare his readers, these Gentile readers left behind in Rome, to prepare his readers for the challenges that the impending influx of Jews, both believing and unbelieving, will present to them by articulating the gospel and its implications to them, by making those the gospel and its implications clear to them. His intention is to articulate the gospel in such a way that it gives his readers the right perspective from which to confront the challenges that they will face and the attacks that they will endure. The Jewish communities have not responded well to Paul's proclamation of the gospel. Those communities are coming to Rome. The Gentiles have not faced that before, the Gentiles left behind. They've not faced those challenges before. And Paul's saying, you're going to have to be ready for them. Let me explain to you the gospel as over against what Pharisaical Judaism says and believes and thinks, and let you understand why the gospel's true and theirs is not true. You need to be ready for their attacks. You need to be ready for their for the onslaught of their criticism of your gospel. In other words, he articulates his gospel in such a way that he attempts to make it abundantly clear what the difference is between the truth of the gospel and the opposing attitudes, beliefs, and teachings of Pharisaical Judaism. And the reason I say Pharisaical Judaism was the Judaism of the masses. The Sadducees were a high, elitist minority of wealthy aristocrats. No ordinary Jew was a Sadducee. Every ordinary Jew, if they were not a Pharisee in membership, the only Judaism they knew was the Judaism that was taught to them by Pharisees. So their whole outlook was Pharisaical. So he knows the problems that are likely to develop with Jews returning to live alongside these Gentile believers. He's writing to fortify them against the attacks of unbelieving Jews against the gospel. And there's two forms that's going to take. Direct attacks against the gospel as being false, which is primarily what Romans has in mind. But also, as we saw from his warning in the cover letter, he's also wanting to fortify them against the false teachers of the type that you find in Colossians or the letters to John or other New Testament letters, where people who ostensibly believe in Christianity, ostensibly believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but actually their view of reality is the same as the Pharisees. And he wants to protect them against being seduced off away from a real understanding of the Messiah into a pseudo-acknowledgement of the Messiah. He also knows the problems that are likely to develop with Jews who are ostensibly believers returning to live alongside these Gentile believers. He's writing to fortify against them the traps, is the word he used in the cover letter, the traps of such false believing Jews that will lead away from belief in the gospel. Then he also understands the problems that are likely to develop with believing Jews living aside believing Gentiles. That's likely to be a problem, because Gentiles have never lived like Jews. They're pagans. They have never ate kosher. They don't dress funny. They don't talk funny. They don't do the stuff that the Jews do as a way of being and as a way of life. And those are going to come into conflict with each other. What are you going to think about each other? How are you going to relate to each other? Are you going to respect each other? Are you going to condemn each other? Are you going to hold each other in contempt? What's going to go on there? And you have a whole section in the latter part of Romans where that's the discussion. Is one man keeps the Sabbath, another one doesn't. One man eats meat, another one doesn't eat meat. One eats kosher, another doesn't eat kosher. One keeps festivals, another doesn't keep festivals. How are you going to relate to each other? Because you are coming from radically different cultural perspectives. So let's understand the gospel adequately in order to be prepared to have the right kind of relationship to each other, Jews to Gentiles. And then finally, it's clear that in this letter, he's writing to prepare them for the fact that he's coming to visit them, because as he writes this letter, he fully intends to take a quick trip to Jerusalem and catch a boat for Rome and be right behind the letter. That's his intention. Didn't quite work out that way, we know from the book of Acts, but that was his intention when he wrote the letter. But I think that's clearly secondary. What prompts the letter is not his plan to come and visit them. That's not, and again, a lot of academic treatment of this letter makes it sound like that's why he wrote it. There's a lot in there for just telling him I'm coming. It's the plan to visit is not what prompted his writing the letter. It's his knowledge that several Jewish companions and fellow believers are returning to Rome, and he wants to prepare the Gentile Christians there for the onslaught of the unbelieving Jews who are going to be coming with them, and the Jews who are false teachers who are likely to follow in their wake. An objection could be raised to this scenario. The letter sounds so Jewish. How could the recipients be Gentiles? Because it sounds so Jewish. Three things. First of all, we have to remember that the initial Gentile believers in every community were largely what are called God-fearers. God-fearers were Gentiles who early on, before Christianity even arose, had become tired and weary of the absurd paganism that was practiced as the state religion of the Roman Empire. They had grown weary of the moral bankruptcy of that. And they had seen in the Jewish synagogue some real substance. Here's something morally substantive. And so they would go hang out at the synagogue and listen to the synagogue services, hearing the Torah read week after week after week, hearing the Torah commented on week after week after week, and over the course of time became very knowledgeable in Torah. So they were not, sometimes a God-fearer could be virtually as knowledgeable in Torah as any typical Jew. You also have to keep in mind that even a Christian believer from an entirely pagan background who is not a God-fearer would be expected and could be expected over time to come to know and understand the Torah. The Torah is the scripture that Gentile believers of the time would have studied. As a Christian believer, as a believer in the Messiah, if you're going to be taught from the scripture, what scripture are you going to learn from? What we call the Old Testament, the Torah. So over the course of time, even if you didn't start off with knowledge of Torah, just your belief in Jesus the Messiah would have got you to be informed familiar with the Torah. I'm not Jewish, but I understand the Torah better than most Jews I have become acquainted with in the course of my life. I'm motivated to know it in a way that they are not. So you don't have to be from a Jewish background to become savvy about what the Torah teaches. And then finally, we're going to see that some of the arguments that we see in the book of Romans are arguments not with the readers, but are arguments with imaginary non-believing Jews. And those are arguments that are conducted with these imaginary non-believing Jews for the benefit of his readers. It would not be unlike if I send my child away to college and they're taking a philosophy class and they're reading a book by Bertrand Russell on why I am not a Christian, for example. And my child writes back and said, I'm reading this book by Bertrand Russell, why I'm not a Christian, and here's what he says. Do you have any comments? I could very well write a letter where basically in the letter I'm interacting with Bertrand Russell's ideas, Bertrand Russell's arguments, Bertrand Russell's perspective, and I'm carrying on an argument with that. I'm not arguing with my child. I'm arguing with Bertrand Russell, but I'm doing so in the purview of my child because I want my child to learn how my perspective differs from Bertrand Russell's, and in fact how my perspective hopefully is superior to that of Bertrand Russell. That's what goes on in the book of Romans a number of times, where the interaction that Paul is having is not with any real live person. It's this generalized, stereotyped Jewish opponent of the gospel, and Paul is interacting with them, arguing with them, making his case to them for the sake of these Gentile readers who need to watch that go down in order to be instructed about what exactly Paul's perspective is. Well, obviously, in any such interaction, he's going to be assuming that Jew who's his opponent is well-versed in Torah, so he writes it accordingly. I have one other topic. Let me just briefly mention it, and I'll take this up again at the beginning of next week, but let me just briefly mention. Why do these things matter? Oftentimes you'll hear people say that the book of Romans is Paul's systematic theology, or this is Paul's final, determinant, decisive articulation of the gospel. And therefore, Romans gets treated by people as if this is the normative explanation of the Bible, and any other explanation of the gospel, the normative explanation of the gospel, the normative articulation of the gospel, and every other articulation of the gospel needs to be measured by how much it does or does not conform to Romans. And that really gets accentuated through the Reformers, because the Reformers came along and one of the slogans they developed is, we're justified by faith alone. We're justified by faith and not by works. And so they reduced that to, we're justified by faith alone. Well, as much as I respect the Reformers, as much as I think that was a very, very appropriate digestion of the content of Romans and Galatians that was appropriate to their context, the same thing happens to that slogan that happens to the book of Romans. Namely, you need to make the slogan, justification by faith, the measuring stone of everything you say about the gospel. Well, I don't think that's true of the Reformers' slogan, and I don't think it's true of the book of Romans. Yes, Paul is going to hammer home in the early chapters, we are justified by faith and not by works of the law. And he's preoccupied with that in the initial arguments of Romans. Why? Is he preoccupied with that because in Paul's mind, this is the one and only one angle of approach to understanding the gospel, and you better approach it that way or you don't have your gospel right? We often read Romans that way. But what I'm going to argue is that Romans was written into a specific occasion and historical set of circumstances just as much as Colossians was, just as much as Ephesians was, just as much as Galatians was, just as much as all the other New Testament letters. Paul did not write, he did not sit down in Cenchrea one night and go, let me write my magnum opus here. This is the magnum opus articulation of the gospel from the Apostle Paul. It's not what he's doing. He has very, very well in mind a particular agenda. I know the criticisms of the gospel that are going to come from Pharisaical Judaism, and these Gentiles in Rome don't have a clue. Let me write a letter to help them understand the gospel from the perspective of its contrast to Pharisaical Judaism, and how the Pharisaical Jews, where they're going wrong, and where they're making mistakes, and where the fallacies are. The Gentiles in Rome need to understand that. So, of course, he starts off contrasting justification by faith with justification by works of the law, because that's the point of contention between these two groups of people that he needs to clarify. It always bothered me once I dared to launch out from Romans and study other parts of the New Testament, how unlike Romans they sounded. It's the same gospel. If it's the same gospel, why doesn't it sound the same? Why are they approaching it differently? Why is it a different angle taken on it? Why so different vocabulary, different concepts are being massaged and worked with? Well, because the gospel is a much larger picture, and you can look at it from a lot of different angles depending upon what needs clarification, what needs discussion, what needs explication. And Romans is just one of them. It's just one angle that you can take on the gospel. And hopefully that'll become clearer as we go through the book. But that's why it's important. That's why knowing why it was written, when it was written, to whom it was written, makes all the difference in the world, because you then become acutely aware that this was written on a particular occasion with a particular agenda in mind. And understanding that then becomes the framework for understanding why he says what he says in the book of Romans and why he says it in the way that he does. Okay, we've got about 10 minutes for your questions.
Thanks, Jack, for all the background. That's always so helpful. I mean, that's the... If we don't understand that, I think you're right on. We can't really grasp the book. And I guess my question pertains to that. And your take on things, you've said a couple of times from the podium today, well, if I'm right about this and I'm right about that, then this follows. And a lot of your ifs are a lot different than we've been taught before. And it's... It seems like I get this picture in my head of either like a single stack of ifs being stacked up or a pyramid, any one of which the Jenga block gets pulled and the whole thing falls down maybe. So can you talk to a little bit about, well, what if this if of mine I'm not right on, does that really make my whole argument crumble, or do I have to turn this way or that way? Do you get what I'm, understand what I'm getting at? I mean, I guess to really articulate that, it's like, you know, the branches on a family tree or something like that. It could just go in 1,000 different directions. Well, if I'm wrong about this and I'm wrong, or I'm wrong about that, or I don't know. Just the how. I guess one question is, how firmly are you planted on your understanding of each of those ifs? And
you know me.
I mean, I know you are, I don't know.
I firmly plant myself with always the reservation I can change my mind later, but I am for now, I am very firm.
But I think you understand the kind of the gravity of my question.
Yeah, no, I do. I'm quite convinced that, I mean, maybe I have some of the irrelevant details, not exactly right, but that the basic concept of what the letter is and why it's written and to whom it's written and so on, I'm really quite confident about that. And it's hard to articulate where that confidence comes from. I mean, I never would have been able to rethink Romans had I not begun to read and study other parts of the New Testament and face the question, okay, so why, what's the same gospel over here as over here if they don't even use the word faith? Or barely use the word faith, and they certainly don't talk about justification. Well, if they don't talk about justification and faith, and the whole central core of the gospel is justification by faith, how is that the gospel? Well, you have to work that through. And so I was forced to come to a much fuller, more comprehensive, more coherent, I think, view of the gospel in the light of the prophets and the Old Testament teaching, by having launched out into other parts of the New Testament. Well, that then allowed me to come back to Romans and say, okay, so if this is not his magnum opus, if this is not the one and only one way to articulate the gospel, then what's going on here? And I was kind of open then and receptive to another way of looking at the letter, and then it was in examining the end of the letter and what the implications of that are that I began to put all this stuff together. So I'm pretty confident because, I mean... As we'll see, and in fact, what I'll do in the next few weeks is show you how the arguments really, if you were Paul, these are the topics you would take up in this situation, in these circumstances. So when you see the coherence of the whole letter and the rationale for what he says when being taken up, then it just dovetails with the occasion in such a way that it just confirms to me that's got to be why he's writing it. Because it just makes too much sense. It's just too coherent.
Right, and that's what I've found to be true of most of your arguments, as I've heard them here and at Bible studies on Thursday. They do make a lot more sense than the other ways of looking at things, and that's obviously why I'm drawn to be sitting here. But I guess my question kind of reformulated better, and maybe like what would be helpful for me would be a list of the priorities of your if statements, kind of like if you're your assessment of the way we're to take the cover letter and the word greet, and are these people actually in Rome or are they coming to Rome? How important is that? If that's not true, does that make your argument crumble, or does it just, is that not really a big deal?
Few of them individually would make it crumble because that's just a matter of timing. So what if they arrived 2 months before the letter? There's still probably the same need for Paul to have written.
Right.
So
I guess that's what I'm getting at. So it's like, okay, how important is that if? And I don't expect you to articulate them all right now. But I guess maybe at some point, kind of an exposition, an appendix to your translation would be kind of, this is really important. If this kind of understanding of mine is not true, then the rest of what I'm saying really breaks down. Yeah. But this little thing, this is what I think, but it's kind of inconsequential. It actually fits better, but it really doesn't affect things.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's very fair. Yeah.
Maybe this goes without saying, or maybe that's what you're implying, but it seems that, or let me ask you the question. Is part of what Paul is anticipating here the dynamic of the Jews coming back and saying to the Gentiles, well, we know the gospel better than you do? And Paul's giving the Gentiles a clear understanding of the gospel from the perspective of the Old Testament, and just that's why he talks about the law so much and all that. Would that be part of the dynamic?
Yeah, I would think so, but you see the other dynamic as well, like in Romans 14, it's going to be the Gentiles, because they are free of the Jewish scruples, are going to have a tendency to think of themselves, hold the Jews in contempt for not being as free and hip as they are. So I think it goes
both ways.
Yeah, but I.
Okay.
Could you identify where Romans appears chronologically with reference to Paul's other letters? In other words, is it an early letter such that other letters might be read in light of Romans, or is it a later letter such that it is closer to a magnum opus, even if it might not be that, or is it just smack in the middle? And
yeah, I think it's just in the middle. I've never actually tried to put them in chronological order. But, I mean, I know there are earlier letters, and I know there are later letters, but I guess that's the middle.
That would be the middle, yes. Thank you. But I think that if that's the case, or to the degree that's the case, it would reinforce your argument then that it's that specificity of it going to this situation in Rome.
Yeah.
I mean, just curious, you know, how much people are aware of what he's already said or not. Yeah, thanks.
Jack, what you talked about the boatload of Jews going back to Rome, and then the casting of them out of Rome.
I'm sorry, the what?
The Antiochus casting of them out of Rome.
Oh, Claudius.
Claudius. Thank you. What historical evidence do we have, or did you have, in terms of knowing or Paul anticipating this mass reintroduction of Jews back into Rome? What evidence is there of that?
You mean that it happened?
Yeah, or was this, was it like, hey, all Jews need to be out for 10 years, and so Paul knew that this was coming again, that they could come back in? Or
well, no, what would have happened is, it had happened once before. The Jews had been kicked out of Rome by an earlier emperor. Don't remember his name. And what happened there is just over time, it's unclear whether they started making their way back before he died, just because, you know, after a number of years have lapsed, the whatever initial anger that led to it kind of subsides, and you can kind of sneak back in, and no one's really paying you no mind. That began to happen before. And then with the death of that emperor, and they have numbers about like the ranks of Jews swelled to 100,000 and that kind of stuff. And the same thing happened after Claudius. I couldn't give you sources right at the moment, but they just talk about it as if everybody knows that. So, okay.
Thanks, Chuck.
Thanks a lot for that, Jack. That was both surprising, and a lot of that was really convincing to me, so that was helpful. You talked about this letter being written mostly to Gentiles, you think, that were in the Roman Church, and then also that there was this, you know, these phantom Pharisees that weren't believers that the questions are addressed to. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense to me, but that's not where I've completely been in the past thinking about this, and I'm wondering if this is a possible picture that balances that out a little bit or not in your mind. I'm thinking it's possible that there had been an influx of Jews in the 2 or 3 years prior to Paul writing Romans, and maybe Paul's addressing problems that have already arisen with Jews arguing with Roman believers instead of Paul anticipating them. And in light of that, also, I've always actually pictured these questions that Paul asks all throughout Romans, where the Pharisee is arguing against the believer. I've always pictured that as a believer arguing, a Jewish believer arguing against a Gentile believer, but the Jewish believer steeped in Phariseeism, and so the Gentile believer is supposed to, or the other believers are supposed to correct that. So is that possible to you? What's coming to mind is like Romans 2:17. If you, a Jew, seeming to address a Jewish believer, and then Paul correcting them. At least that's how I've been taking that. If you know,
could
what I'm
you repeat about. That last thing again?
In Romans 2:17, I think Paul says, "And you, a Jew, if you stand upon the law and such." It seems to me that that's addressing a Jewish believer in Rome that's incorrect about his, how he's thinking about things or something. So I don't know if that all made sense.
Yeah, I'll try to make sense out of that part of Romans 2 differently than that. I think it's entirely possible, you know, your initial suggestion that could these be problems that have already arisen because they have already come into collision, yeah. The only reason I don't go there is I'm trying to understand all these greetings in the end of 16, and so that's what makes me think that this is actually happening in anticipation of that rather than...
Certainly Paul's making it worse, but are all these Jews coming back going to make the problem, you know, get bigger? Right,
right. Exactly. Now, he says things, he'll say things like in chapter 2 about, as some say that we say, and as some slanderously report that we say. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's been going on in Rome, because I think what Paul is arguing there is, throughout the whole Roman Empire, this has been the response of Jews to his gospel, is here's what they accuse him of, and here's what they say. So I think what he's doing in Romans is anticipating all the real live, real world criticisms that he knows he has encountered throughout his ministry, and he knows it's going to be replayed all over again in Rome, so let me let you in on how I would interact with that. Okay, about one more, and then we better call it a morning.
So, Jack, I first heard you teach Romans 20 years ago. And back then, you had said that you had been studying it for a number of years and felt quite confident in what you were saying.
Yeah.
But you did say specifically that you reserve the right to change your mind. I'm thinking when you get to heaven and you sit down with the Apostle Paul, which will be a very long line, I think, once you finally get up to him, you'll be probably glad that, as maybe you'll be more right than most people, but you'll be glad to say, hey, I always said I could change my mind, so thanks a lot. So I have a quick question.
You'll know that I'm having the interview when you hear Paul say, you said what?
Yeah, he'll just say, you know, geez, I never had any idea this thing would be such a big deal. So I have a question. He says, greet Andronicus and Junius, my kinsmen and fellow prisoners. They are eminent among the apostles. Are we to see them as apostles in the same way we normally think of apostles? And just a side question, as you know, Junius sometimes is
feminine.
Feminine, and so some people point to, here's an example of not only another apostle, but as a woman being an apostle. What's your take on that?
Okay, I'm still working on that in terms of whether it's masculine or feminine. I'm leaning toward feminine at this point, but that's a really tough call because it's impossible to tell. The only difference is in the accent. If you use a circumflex accent, it will be masculine. If you use an acute accent in an earlier syllable, it'll be feminine. And how do you know? Because the original text had no accents. They were just letters. So there's a real ambiguity there that there's no way to ultimately decide. There's two issues. One is, what exactly does he mean by imminent among the apostles? Is it a way of speaking where you are saying these people belong to the set of apostles as some of them and are imminent? Or is it there's this set of people over here called the apostles, and they have a point of view toward Andronicus and Junius that they are imminent in their perspective toward them? I think that's a very real possibility. In fact, I think I lean that way. But the other possibility is we know that Barnabas, for example, is called an apostle. Other people are called apostles that are not part of the 12. And the question is, an apostle of what? Are you an apostle of Jesus? That is, have you been sent out as a spokesperson for Jesus? Or you are an apostle of the Antioch church, because the Antioch church has sent you out to spread this gospel. Paul and Barnabas were apostles of the Antioch church, very clearly. Paul was also an apostle of Jesus Christ. Was Barnabas an apostle of Jesus Christ? I would argue I don't think in the same sense that Paul was. So apostle doesn't have to mean that class of people that has been sent out by Jesus with the authority of Jesus, that they can speak with the authority of Jesus. It just means that they are missionaries sent out by the early churches to evangelize. And they could clearly be eminent among the apostles, classed with them in that sense, where they are missionaries. And some commentators argue that they are two men who were, like Paul and Barnabas, were just companions who always traveled together and worked together. Might be. But they could very well be husband and wife as well, it seems to me. I need to let you go, and we'll pick it up here next week. That is-